This is WILF's Wake Up Call, WILF being the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. We come to you every Friday morning from 7:30 to 8 o'clock, bringing you some of the hot issues of the day that affect both the community or the region or the nation. And today our guest is Beth Brockman, who recently went on a trip to the Mideast, to Egypt, Israel, and Palestine, and left May 8th and came back on the 18th. And she's here to tell us about her, excuse me, I'm croaky this morning, about her journey, what led her to go there, and some of her experiences. So, good morning, Beth.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and maybe we could start off telling us about some of the reasons or feelings that led you to go on this trip to a relatively dangerous part of the world.
Well, in the 1980s and early 90s, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Sri Lanka, and it was there that I really learned firsthand how war affects a country. Mm. When I was living there, not only were the Tamil Tigers fighting for independence, but the Sri Lankan army also brought in an Indian peacekeeping force from India. And there was a underground Marxist party that was also very active in the region of the country where I lived, in the south. In my 20s, everything seemed very exciting politically. And I read the newspapers and I followed everything very, very closely. And really bought into the Marxist rhetoric at that time. It just seemed so much better than the status quo. The president of the country at the time was training paramilitary groups, and it was even rumored that they were being trained by the Mossad. And I quickly became disillusioned with the government and soon thereafter with the Marxists as well, because it just seemed that there was so much violence, there was so much death, and especially innocent people. And it was about that time that I heard about a Brazilian educator named Paulo Freire, everybody's nodding in agreement. You know, whose basic premise is that the purpose of education is to motivate people to challenge the things in society that oppress them. And so that seemed like the real revolution to me. And so I really kind of shut down a part of myself and threw myself kind of into education. When I returned back from the Peace Corps, it was the time of the invasion of Kuwait, and I was living in Mississippi at the time. And people were tying yellow ribbons around trees and supporting the troops. And it was really hard for me. I didn't really know what to say, especially I'm coming back from Peace Corps. I'm still fairly young, in my 20s. And I don't feel like I have a leg to stand on by saying, don't you know what war means? Don't you know who really suffers? And so I continued to kind of just teach and throw myself into that, and committed myself to that revolution. Mm-hmm. And I was very fortunate to be able to use, you know, Freirean techniques with day laborers in Seattle and in a Goodwill Community Literacy Center. It was really wonderful. When I moved to North Carolina with my husband in 1997, again, I taught farm workers and continued to kind of use Freirean principles to kind of guide my work and continue
to... And that is extremely important work.
Exactly. I don't dismiss that at all. And I still consider myself a teacher. That's what I do. I teach English as a second language. I don't get paid to do it very often anymore. mostly volunteer work at this point. But it wasn't until, you know, a few years ago when a friend of mine crossed the line at the School of the Americas that I realized there's another way to express my faith and another way to resist. And it kind of woke up that part of me that realized what war really meant, and just became much more aware of the violence and the militarism that exists here in the United States. And so I'm leading up to the trip. I'm going to get there.
The journey is what's so important, how you came to that point.
And so when the airstrikes started in December last year, mm-hmm. on Gaza and continued on into January, my heart just broke for a people that, you know, are under siege since Israel pulled out in 2005. Have been under siege, and now they're being attacked. And I couldn't help but think of the, you know, who knows how many thousands. You know, I've heard 250, 300,000 civilians that were trapped up in the north of Sri Lanka by the Sri Lankan army there. And a similar situation in that the Sri Lankans won't let, you know, human rights workers in there, aid workers, not even their own journalists can go into the north part of Sri Lanka. So when the airstrike started on Gaza, I just was riveted to the photographs that I saw, to the news, and I just, it broke my heart.
Yeah.
And of course, that's much more in the media than Sri Lanka is, although Sri Lanka obviously continues to be as well. So when a man from Worcester, Massachusetts put out a kind of call to put together a Catholic worker peace team to go to Gaza, I immediately responded and said that I was interested in going. His name is Scott Schaefer Duffy, and this is the sixth peace team that he's organized.
Wow.
Five of them have gone to the Middle East and one to Darfur. So continued with the process of just organizing, trying to put together a team, what would that look like? And in the end, made the decision that that team should be small so that we could move quickly and easily. We knew that we would try to, as best as we could, to make decisions by consensus, so smaller was definitely better. Gender balance was something that was really important. And so six people then formed the team, three women and three men. And most of them, I will say, are Catholic, though not, I'm not Catholic myself, and there was one other woman on the team that wasn't Catholic. But all are drawn to the principles of the Catholic worker, of, you know, Dorothy Day and Peter Marin's movement that started during the Depression, with, you know, calling for houses of hospitality and doing the acts of mercy, as well as resistance to empire. So there are...
So you're not Catholic yourself?
I'm not Catholic myself. My husband's Catholic.
Ah.
And my children both are baptized and have taken First Communion. But we attend two churches, a Catholic church and a Presbyterian church.
Okay. So that's really interesting. But the Catholic worker way of looking at things is what really appeals to you.
Yes, definitely. So I was glad to be part of this team. Two people from Worcester, Massachusetts, a man from New Haven, Connecticut, a young man who teaches at a Jesuit high school in California, myself, and then a woman from Vermont who works in the law school there, formed the team. And because Scott had organized these teams in the past and has spent quite a bit of time in Israel and Palestine, he kind of came up with an itinerary, a framework for us. One of the women from Worcester also lived in the West Bank for 3 months with the Michigan peace teams. So she was familiar with the Arabic language and the culture. So they provided a nice base, I think, for those of us that had never traveled before to Israel or Palestine. I had never been before and certainly didn't think I would ever, ever travel there. But this was certainly a call that I felt.
So you left on May 8th, and where did you first go, to Egypt or Israel?
We flew into Cairo with the idea of going to the American embassy, where we had been told by people that have gotten into Gaza before that the Egyptians were requiring us to have an affidavit that basically said that the embassy was not responsible for us once we crossed into the border with Gaza, since there's a travel advisory there. So we flew in on a Saturday, and the following morning picked up our affidavit, and then had a car and a driver that took us to El Arish, which is the closest town to the border with Gaza. And there's on the other side of Gaza, the town's called Rafah, but there's also an Egyptian side of Rafah. There's no place really to stay. But once we got into El Arish on that Sunday evening, we were told that the border was closed, so we spent the night in El Arish and then went to the border at 6 the following morning, where we were for 16 hours at that border.
Gosh.
And we were there for about maybe 5 hours before anybody else except for military showed up. The border was closed except for military personnel coming in and out. And whether that be by bus, in tanks, those were the only people crossing the border for about 5 hours. At about 11 o'clock, two ambulances showed up with three women and three children. And they came out and sat. There was like a little like cement block building that had like a cafeteria in it, although it just made coffee and tea and had, you know, snacks there. Then also some Gazan doctors arrived to also wait for the border to be opened. The three women, one of them spoke fairly good English, and she explained to us that they had received permits in Gaza to take their children to Cairo to have heart surgery. And the ages of the children were 1, 2, and 3.
And the surgery was on one of the children?
All of them.
All of the children?
All three children had open heart surgery.
Oh my gosh.
And had come from the hospital in Cairo with the hopes of getting into the border that day.
Oh, and that's why the ambulances pulled up.
Right. So they had, it was a month after their surgeries, and now they were waiting at the border to go through. And when we talked to the Gazan doctors there and also to these three women, they just said, this is our life. We wait and we wait and we wait.
Mm.
And with no clear understanding of why we weren't being allowed through, we also, of course, were making a plea to get through the border as well.
But even whoever is in charge of the border, seeing these ambulances, these little children who are at risk, that did not move hearts enough to let them in.
No. They have to wait for their intelligence to allow them to open the border.
Oh.
And an American official, we don't know what, if it's military, had come into the border and was having meetings there through the afternoon. And we were told by people on the outside that the border would not be open until this American official left the buildings there in the border, and that seemed to be the case.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, these three women are sitting there with their children, and we also talked to them about the airstrikes that happened in December and January. One of them lost her son. Another woman, her son's arm was severed.
Muna, my God.
The woman that spoke quite good English, her cousin was killed. So they really felt very kind of terrorized, and at the same time that they felt privileged to be able to take their children out, that they were able to get these permits, and yet they had to sit here and wait for hours and hours and hours to get into the border. And one of the baby especially, one of the women, I held this child so she could eat for a little while, needed to be in the hospital. And so the baby couldn't go back to El Arish. It needed to go back either to the hospital in Cairo or to the hospital in Gaza City. So it was just heartbreaking to hear the stories of their suffering and tremendous grief and frustration, you know, over kind of the daily life. Finally, around 4:30, 5 o'clock, the American official left. And then there was just kind of this mad rush. The ambulances did get to go through with the three women and three children. The doctors went through. There were three of them. And then maybe 10 other Gazans with refrigerators and just small bags. But that's all we saw cross the border other than military for 16 hours. By the end of the day...
But you didn't get through.
No. We were told that the affidavit was not good enough. Our embassy needed to contact Egyptian intelligence and give permission for us to come through the border. And we told them we had everything we needed. The embassy had already told us. They're going to say, we need to call. We're not calling. We also heard the following day, there were three internationals that worked with an Austrian Arab organization that's been had a presence in the Middle East for about 20 years. They had all that. And then they were also told that they needed permission from the municipality in El Arish, the town that's close by, in order to get through. So they then had to contact their Egyptian embassy in Austria, who contacted the municipality in El Arish. And finally, those three internationals were allowed through. By the second day, we decided that we were going to kind of up the ante a little bit. And so we decided that part of our protest would be to pray the rosary, which we did every hour.
Mm-hmm.
Our medical supplies we brought with us. We brought a Christian organization donated about $18,000 worth of medical supplies,
okay,
which we had in large bags with us. And that second day when we were at the border, we prayed the rosary every hour. We went every on the hour to ask, mm-hmm, could we please get through the border. They kept telling us the same, well, not really the same thing. You need permission from your embassy needs to call our intelligence. Mm-hmm. You need permission from El Arish, that municipality.
Well, this story, I'm going to take a break right here. We have a break in the middle. But this story just brings home that, you know, Gaza is a prison. I mean, to have such tight control that ambulances, doctors, people with the right documentation can't get in, and I'm sure it's even as difficult, if not more difficult, to get out. I mean, this is a prison, and that's why I think we were all horrified by the bombing, because it was like they were sitting ducks. They had no place to hide. A lot of times you think of other wars so people can escape up into the woods or over the mountain, or, you know, no escape.
No escape.
No escape. This is Wilp's Wake Up Call. We're brought to you every Friday morning from 7:30 to 8 o'clock. I'm Lori Hoyt, and my guest today is Beth Brockman, who was just recently back from a trip to Egypt, Israel, Palestine, and telling us some stories that give flesh and blood and heart to the news that we have been hearing with such sadness. We are underwritten by Internationalist Books, 405 West Franklin Street, and you can go to internationalistbooks.com. Also, you can get our broadcast, trianglewilf.org, and Wilf has a P in it, WILPF, trianglewilf.org. And we are brought to you by WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. And you can stream live and find out more about that by going to WCOMFM.org. And this is your local volunteer-run radio station bringing you the kind of news that you don't get in the major media. And we're happy to be here with Beth Brockman this morning, even though we're hearing such tragic stories that won't surprise us, but really make us realize yet again what's happening in that part of the world. So let's pick up, Beth. So when you couldn't get into Gaza, what did you all do?
Well, they wouldn't allow us to cross into the border, we thought that they would take the medical supplies. In the end, they also said that they would not take those supplies through.
Oh.
So we really had to have a conversation about what was going to happen. And we did have contacts in Gaza, doctors as well as another friend. And so in the end, we left the bags with someone who ensured us that they would get into the border, cross the border and into Gaza. A week later, we did find out that they did make it to the hospital where we had intended them to get. And we also got a laptop into one of the doctors at the El Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. Electronics are also not allowed. It was just very poignant. It's like you said earlier, it is like a prison. I don't know. I've never been at a border in which it's people don't cross.
Yeah.
There's no line at that border. There's no goods crossing. There's no construction materials. And that is the Egyptian border with Gaza. And I've heard that the Israeli border with Gaza is also extremely tight.
And then, you know, then they wonder why there are so many tunnels. A lot of those tunnels, you know, the propaganda is that it's to bring in arms. There may be some of them, but mostly it's to bring in some food supplies, some building supplies, some things that are medical supplies that are desperately, desperately needed. And I've seen a documentary on it, and you just don't get to hear that, to understand that these people are forced to be like animals burrowing into the earth to just keep some necessary things for survival going. And the other thing I just heard from the UN rapporteur, was it yesterday or the day before, that a lot of the children in Gaza are stunted because they're not getting enough food. And, you know, and why we don't have more of an outcry. I don't care if you're Christian or Muslim or Jewish. You know, we need to have an outcry that this is happening. It's in this supposedly civilized time. It just is absolutely outrageous. But let me be quiet and let's hear your stories before I... And let me get off my soapbox here a minute.
So from Egypt, we did talk about what should we stay at the border. Would they? I think eventually they probably would have let us through. Mm-hmm. I think our presence would have started to embarrass the officials there at the border. But we had other things planned, so we ended up by car leaving El Arish and driving the length of the Sinai to the border at Taba. Where that's where tourists can cross into Israel, and then came and drove up into the West Bank, into Bethlehem, where we spent 3 days at the Dahesha refugee camp. This particular camp is quite active and has done a lot to appeal to internationals. They have set up a guest house. They have a lot of sports activities for the kids. I mean, there's 12,000 people living in this less than 1 kilometer square area. It's extremely dense, so it felt a bit luxurious to have a room with only 3 people in it, versus I'm sure a lot more. And it was a wonderful opportunity to meet some of the Palestinians that are living there in the refugee camp, which many of them have lived there even since before 48. Generations have really grown up in this refugee camp. Things have changed through time. There's no longer a fence around it that came down in the 90s. But it's still a refugee camp, and some have been able to leave. Some have felt forced to leave. Of course, we know that there's over 6 million Palestinian refugees, not only in the West Bank, but in Lebanon and Jordan, scattered throughout the world.
I didn't know, 6 million?
Mm-hmm. That's the number that we heard, was 6 million. So we spent some time in the refugee camp meeting people and talking with them. They use the walls there as almost a kind of a newspaper, so you can kind of see chronicled things through time, paintings of individuals who've been martyred, killed by Israelis, children, men, women. And we not only spent time in Bethlehem, but we visited Hebron, which is a little more dangerous than Bethlehem. We didn't feel any danger, but there's a settlement that exists there that's actually above, like a Palestinian market. There's roads there that Palestinians can't drive on, they can't walk on, so those shops have been completely shut up. We had a Palestinian guide who, wasn't allowed to walk down this particular street with us, just because it's not allowed.
These are the apartheid roads.
These are apartheid roads. And just as an example, the trip we took from El Arish to the West Bank, if we were able to drive it straight on a road that does, you know, exist, it would have taken us about an hour. The trip that we took us about 15 hours.
Oh my gosh, because you're not allowed on the roads.
And we're also, there's only particular border crossings between Egypt and Israel in which people are allowed through. Commercial goods are allowed through other crossings, but we had to go through the tourist one. And I think this is the Palestinians' life. Mm-hmm. It's being rerouted, it's waiting, it's being kind of inconvenienced, it's always waiting for perhaps something bad to happen, your house to be demolished. We met, you know, a farmer in which these farmers in this particular valley outside of Hebron have been accused of stealing water. So the government came in, the Israelis came in, and pulled up all their irrigation pipes. Took about 20 truckloads off, and they have no way to irrigate their crops. This one man that we met, his name is Atta Jaber and Jowdy, Jaber, his brother. Jowdy's house has been demolished to make way for a settlement that exists close by. And the farm that was once 70 acres is now 7.
Oh.
This family has really suffered a lot through time.
The fury and that must be engendered by that kind of treatment and the constant humiliation.
It's very difficult for them. And, you know, we did participate. There's a weekly protest that takes place in the town, the village of Belin, mm-hmm. and where there's a fence that's been erected over 4 years ago that cuts them off about 60% of their agricultural lands. And they've been protesting this fence weekly for 4.5 years. 5 weeks ago, one of their leaders was killed when a tear gas canister was shot at him from close range, hit him in the chest, and he was killed. So the village was really mourning. And even when we participated in this protest, which is against a fence that's illegally placed, the Israelis fired over 100 tear gas canisters.
Okay, Beth, we have about 3 minutes left, and I did want to get to your sense with, I think you got to Israel also, mm-hmm. in talking to people in Israel and Palestine, their feelings, and do they have any hope for peace, or, you know, what did you learn while you were there? What was your sense of possibilities?
What we heard over and over and over again is not anything new. If you want peace, you've got to work for justice. There has to be equal rights for all people. And we not only talked with Palestinians, but also with Israelis. When we participated in that protest, there were Israelis present there.
Oh, that's heartening.
You know, former soldiers. Of course, they're all conscripted into the military.
Yeah.
But we met some amazing Israeli human rights activists. Nomika Zion in Sderot, a town that's about a kilometer from Gaza, is an amazing activist, part of this group called Other Voice, in which they communicate with Gazans on a weekly basis. Mm-hmm. We met a family whose house had been hit by a Hamas rocket from Sderot, or from Gaza to Sderot. But even they said that the militarism of Israel and the siege and the walls and the chance that your house could possibly demolish is just creating the climate for terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Palestinians in East Jerusalem are being driven out to kind of make way for more Israelis and Jews to come in and settle in those areas. But both Israelis and Palestinians were saying that we have to, most people mentioned a two-state solution, but there was even one Palestinian, he said, I don't care, make it one state, as long as we have equal rights.
Yeah. And you wonder if they're going to absolutely forfeit the possibility of a two-state solution with all the settlements there. It just gets to seem so difficult. But that is heartening that at least some Israelis are also seeing the need for a different way of doing things.
Definitely.
Yeah. How are we doing on time, Dick? Okay. Well, we have 1 minute. Do you want to maybe tell people some things that they could do or somebody that they can get in touch with to support the efforts that you're in and other people who are working for justice in the Mideast are doing?
There's a lot of great organizations, and I think that if you just went onto the internet, you could find, you know, a lot of them. There's Combatants for Peace. That's a Palestinian group. Well, it's actually Israeli and Palestinian former combatants that are working towards peace. Most of the Palestinians we talked about divestment and boycotts of Israel, not only tourism, but other products.
Like sort of what happened with South Africa.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're wrapping up now. This is Lori Hoyt with Wilf's Wake Up Call. I've been talking to Beth Brockman about a trip to the Mideast. I think we could have about another dozen programs on aspects of this. We're coming from WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. And stay tuned next week. We're going to have some young people on talking about voter rights for young people and pre-registration for young people. And we'll see you next week.